Alrighty. So, as I said, I'm going to be talking tonight about play. I'm going to be talking about play from a developmental perspective as well as a theological perspective, per the title here. The idea of play is deceptively simple. We tend to associate play with the world of children, and rightly so. But I'm gonna talk about childhood quite a bit, but I'm also gonna try and pull this out and make this applicable to all of us in the room who are adults or grown children, however you want to think about it. I think I'll tell you a little bit more in a minute, but play is something that I actually studied as part of my academic training. But as I've thought about the role of play or lack thereof in my own life, and as I've lived and worked alongside people at LaBrie, I've just seen more and more how important a piece this is to the idea of being human. So that's where I'm trying to go with this tonight. Before I get started and taint your minds with anything, I just want to ask you guys a question. I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to think of your answer, and I want you to just hold it in your mind because we're going to come back to it in a minute. So I essentially just want to ask you, when you hear the word play and you think about it in terms of your own childhood, what is the first thing that comes to mind? Don't say it out loud. Just whatever the first thing is that comes to your mind, kind of grab that and hold it there, and we'll revisit that. Okay. So I chose this topic for two reasons. In my former life, before coming to LaBrie, I worked as a pediatric speech-language pathologist. That's what my academic background and much of my work background is in. And I know from my work in that area how critical it is for children to develop appropriate play skills. There are a ton of changes taking place in the U.S. education system right now, as well as the wider culture within the U.S., that's really threatening children's ability to play well, which seems sort of like a crazy thing, but it's true. And there's some people in the room who are educators, and I look forward to hearing their input when we move to discussion. But it's becoming a really big issue for kids, for the development and well-being of kids, who will then turn into adults. Adults often view play as something trivial and meaningless. We tend to see it as something that kids do so that adults can stick to, like, the real work of life, getting things done, doing our jobs, getting meals prepared, getting emails returned. We tend to use the term play really pejoratively. So we might, whenever we try to describe something as being easy or mindless, we often describe it as being child's play, right? That's a term we use a lot. And this line of thinking may seem like a small thing, but it really has a serious impact on all of us because it's important for adults to play too. And if it's something that we really easily minimize, then we're that much less likely to engage in play ourselves. And I want to think about, as we move through this lecture, what it means for all of us to continue playing into adulthood. This is something that's a challenge for me, so I would love to hear some thoughts from you guys when we talk about what play looks like practically in your own lives. The theologian G.K. Chesterton famously said, "Angels can fly because they take themselves lightly." And this is a quote that's been stitched on throw pillows and, like, cute little things to hang on the wall. But in reality, we grown-ups take ourselves quite seriously most of the time. This is something I struggle with personally. I tend to take myself way too seriously. And we tend to focus so much on achievement and efficiency that we can lose sight of other things. So when I first started putting together some ideas on play for this lecture, I started by asking the question, what is play? And I immediately got stuck. I immediately hit a wall. It's actually somewhat difficult to define and to kind of put shape to this idea of play. So I did what you do. You look it up in the dictionary. So just a couple definitions that came up. from the dictionary, to exercise or employ oneself in diversion, amusement, or recreation, to act the part or character in real life, to engage in. So wanting to flesh this out a bit more, I went to the next level, which was LaBrie students. Not you guys in the room, but a couple terms ago, I had a conversation with our LaBrie students and asked them this question: what is play? And they struggled, but came up with some good ideas that I think help us get a little bit closer to get a better idea of what we're going for. So they said play has to do with joy, imagination, fun, humor, trust, wonder, pleasure, creativity, improvisation, and lack of competition. And I thought that was a pretty great list. There are a lot of things on that list that really resonate with me, and hopefully they do with you as well. But wanting to dig a bit deeper, I went to the real experts, who are some of the children in my life. I just want to say, some of you in this room will recognize the names that belong to some of these quotes. These are a couple years old. I actually tried to get some new quotes this time around and failed, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But okay, so here's a couple things. So I asked them either to tell me what play is or what they thought adults needed to know about play. So Claire said, I like to make things and build things. Michael said, grown-ups need to know that it's okay for kids to play with Play-Doh. Ellie said, I love to play outside, and I like playing with my friends. Abby, we're going to come back to this, said, grown-ups don't know how to play. They grow up and forget, so they have to learn again. Kids have to teach them. And Jacob Chestnut, I know a lot of things about play, but it's all in my head, and I can't actually tell you with my mouth. Why don't you do a lecture about baseball instead? I can tell you a lot about baseball. So for those of you who know Jacob, you can probably picture this coming out of his mouth. So I had my work cut out for me here. So I did try this week to get some updated quotes. I talked to Abby. Abby said, it's not work. I said, what is play? And she said, it's not work. Today, I wish Ben had been videotaping this interaction. I went to talk to Noah and Jacob, who were up in Ben and Akela's living room playing Legos. So I attempted to break into what was going on there to ask them these questions. They couldn't even look at me. I mean, they were so in the zone, and Ben's in the background going, guys, listen to Mary Frances. She's asking you something. Listen to Mary Frances. And there was something about a ninja. I don't know. Anyway, they didn't answer the question, which I think tells us a lot. They were so engrossed in what they were doing that the outside stimuli weren't getting in, which I think says something in and of itself. So instead of asking what is play, it's better to ask, why does play matter? Why are we even talking about this? So in order to do this, I'm going to give you a very quick lesson. Don't fade out on me already. In early human development, neuroscience, and linguistics. So this is part of my background. We have a lot of liberal arts people in the room right now, so this is going to be quick. We're not going to do a deep dive, so hopefully I won't lose you on this. But I think it's really important. I think the brain science that goes with this is really fascinating and really critical to the argument of why kids need to play and why we need to play. So for those of you who don't have children or don't regularly spend time around children, don't tune this out. What I'm talking about here impacts all of us. So if you're in this room and you have age-appropriate functional language skills, what I'm about to describe is you, is what happened to you when you were young. So this has to do with you. So we know from science, from neuroscience, that our brains are made up of neurons. So neurons are cells that we have actually all throughout our bodies, but they're the primary way that information is mapped and transmitted in our brains. So here's just a rough schema of human brain. It's not actually that color. There's colors. It's not, but anyway, you've got the four lobes, the cerebellum, and then our spinal cord is there. This is a picture of a neuron. So each neuron has many branches that stem off of it called dendrites. Here, all these little arms. And each neuron has one dendrite that's very long called the axon that's there. The job of the axon is to send information to other neurons. This is the way that neural connections and neural pathways are created in our brains. So this is the end of an axon, that long piece. This is the end of a dendrite from another neuron. And the neurotransmitters are what carry information across. They don't actually touch. There's this gap, and neurotransmitters travel across that gap, the synapse, and that's how our brain works. That's how information travels in our brain. Babies develop over 100 billion neurons within the first 5 months of gestation. So before they're born, first 5 months of gestation, over 100 billion neurons in their brain. But when newborns come into the world, their brains are only about a quarter of the size of an adult brain. However, it grows to about 80% of an adult brain's size by age 3 and 90% of an adult brain's size by age 5. So really quick, really rapid development within the first couple years of life. With every sensory experience, no matter how small or seemingly insignificant, new neural connections are made. The type of connections made and the rate at which they're made has a great deal to do with cognitive functioning down the road. So these are key years for human development. Children's brains are wired to make these connections much more quickly and efficiently than an adult's brain. That's what is referred to as brain plasticity, so the ability of your brain to make new connections and form new pathways. And this is why it's so much easier for kids to, like, learn a foreign language or learn an instrument or learn to ski. It's why a 5-year-old can learn to ski much easier than a 45-year-old can. same thing, language, all that stuff. There's a fairly steep drop-off in brain plasticity around the age of 12 or 13, and then it just continues to go down from there. It's never totally lost. As you know, adults can learn things all the time. It's just much slower. It's much more effort than it does for children to learn things. When we talk about kids being sponges, and it seems like, gosh, they just absorb things and pick up things like that, that's what's happening for them. Adults are very rarely described as sponges. So babies come into the world with all kinds of neural potential. So when they first come into the world, they have the potential to be able to write symphonies and speak 6 languages and do quantum physics and tie their shoes and cook eggs, all these different things, right? There's the potential in their little brains. But what happens to their brains in the early years plays a really critical role determining what they actually will be able to do down the road and how all these things will integrate. But the starting point to this journey is play. Sharon Begley is a former science columnist. She's a scientist, and she's a former columnist for Newsweek magazine. This is one of her quotes, which I love. She says, "You hold your newborn so his sky blue eyes are just inches from the brightly patterned wallpaper. Zit! A neuron from his retina makes an electrical connection with one in his brain's visual cortex. You gently touch his palm with a clothespin. He grasps it, drops it, and you return it to him with soft words and a smile. Crackle. Neurons from his hand strengthen their connection to those in his sensory motor cortex. He cries in the night. You feed him, holding his gaze, because nature has seen to it that the distance from a parent's crooked elbow to his eyes exactly matches the distance at which a baby focuses. Zap! Neurons in the brain's amygdala send pulses of electricity through the circuits that control emotion. You hold him on your lap and talk, and neurons from his ears start hardwiring connections to the auditory cortex, and you thought you were just playing with your kid. So why does play matter? When babies and children's play, they are learning. It looks like they're just, like, hanging out and doing nothing, especially tiny babies who are just sort of like amoebas who really seem to be doing nothing. But they're learning, and they're learning at an incredibly rapid pace. So batting a mobile above a crib, gnawing on the corner of a book, stacking blocks and knocking them down again, pushing a toy car, repeatedly dropping their cup off the high chair tray, someone picking it up, dropping it off again, banging a spoon against a coffee table. This is what learning looks like. Not flashcards, not baby Einstein videos, not iPad apps. This is what learning looks like for kids, for infants and for toddlers and for children. And I would argue that this is actually the most important learning of their lives, far more important than the calculus class they'll take 15, 20 years down the road. So I'm going to show you kind of what typical development of play skills looks like, and I'm going to introduce you to a few little cute people along the way, just so you get an idea of where kids go with this. So there are six stages of object play. This is just one way of looking at play in children is object play. I'm just going to go through this quickly. The first is random and exploratory play. This happens shortly after birth, the first couple months of life. Babies reach out and grasp for familiar people or toys. They do the repetitive motor movements of mouthing things, banging things, shaking things, batting at toys. I'm going to show you a little video. I'm going to have to check. I didn't test the sound, so I hope this is loud enough. This is Tate. So crazy. Tate's like three now. But he was 2.5 months, maybe, during this video. So Tate's going to just give you a little example of this. You just have to wait for it on this one. Okay, so that's Tate. That looks like nothing's happening there, right? But this is really significant, what just happened. His mom, my friend Dara, he was laying there. She touched the elephant. It rattled. He was watching it. He got his hand up there to touch it in response to that. That's really, really significant. Okay, the second stage is cause and effect play. I'm actually going to come back to this a little bit later in the lecture, but cause and effect play emerges around 9 months. And this is just what it sounds like. It's a purposeful interaction as a child learns that they have some control. So pushing something, pulling something, pounding, battery-operated cause and effect toys. So learning you can push a button and a sound will be made, or like a jack-in-the-box. You know, you do something and then it pops out. Caregivers are included in this too. Caregivers often function as a cause and effect toy for kids. So if they drop it and you pick it up, or if they do something, you go, and you respond, that's a cause and effect interaction there. It doesn't just have to be a toy. The third one is purposeful or functional play. This emerges around 15 to 18 months. And children start demonstrating understanding of object uses. So they get that a ball is meant to be thrown in a basket, or a train doesn't sit there. You can move it on the tracks. They can, most of them are not using language at all, but they can respond to directives. They understand a lot, and they can respond appropriately to a lot of directives, such as if you say, what do you eat? They might pick up a toy apple as opposed to a train. They can hand you the apple over the train. This is Zachary. He, I think, was about 18 months when we did this. This is a little hard to hear, but so Zach's mom, Tracy, is playing with him, and his older sister is running her mouth over off to the side. And so just, you want to pay attention, because Tracy at one point tells Claire to be quick, to shh, says shh. And just watch him, see what he does. He's playing with the shape sorter.
Can
try and say ball. So that's a perfect example of that. So he heard Tracy say to Claire, shh, and he did that. Right? So he, just understanding that, and there's an appropriate response to that that he's giving. Okay, the fourth is representational or symbolic play. This emerges usually between 2.5 to 3 years, depending. Kids begin to use symbolism in play, so a cardboard box becomes a house, a spoon becomes a phone. They can play with things out of context, so they're integrating more memory and past experiences. I wanted to videotape this week. I didn't get a chance to, but Joshua and Sarah's daughter Lily, who's almost 2.5, is doing this, and one of the examples I thought of with Lily is she'll use anything around her to make a bunny castle. So she has a stuffed bunny that she loves, and Lily can turn anything into a bunny castle, right? And so you see her playing with anything. You're like, what are you doing, Lil? And she's like, bunny castle. She's making a bunny castle. Number 5 is constructive play. This emerges around 4 years of age when kids use objects for a specific purpose or end goal. So Noah and Jacob today were using Legos to make something, make characters. They had a whole thing going on. That's what they were doing today. So Legos, chalk, Play-Doh, anything like that. And then the last one is imaginative or themed play. This emerges between 4 and 5 years, and this is where kids can create whole play schemas based on past events, and it can be more complex. It can involve a number of steps. So they're not only responding to what's right in front of them. They can remember things that have happened in the past, and they can integrate them in creative ways. So playing with dress-up clothes, kids who pretend to be a doctor because they went to the doctor a month ago, that type of thing. This is the last video. This is Ethan. So I'm sort of narrating this in the video because Ethan is a little boy I used to see for speech therapy, and his articulation is not great. He's not terribly intelligible. And he's also not facing the camera most of the time. But just to tell you what he's doing here, he's made something out of Legos, and it's a flying ice cream truck. Okay, that's what he made out of Legos. And I'm sort of narrating a little bit. I'll do a little more narration as we go. But he's got a whole thing going with the flying ice cream truck. He's saying, I have to get some more. I'm going to get 5 of them.
So he's reloading his ice cream, stocking up.
Yeah, he has to go get the gas.
To go get gas?
Yeah, so I'm running out of gas.
Uh-oh. That'd be bad news if the ice cream truck runs out of gas.
Okay, he's at the gas station.
He's at the gas station.
Do-do-do. He's filling it up with the gas. He's doing it. Time to go. We've got to fill her up.
He's ready for action again.
Okay. So there's Ethan. So the thing about Ethan is that Ethan's never seen a flying ice cream truck before because they don't exist. Right? So he's not just copying something he's seen before. He's integrating a number of different things he's experienced. He may have experienced an ice cream truck on his street. I don't know. He might have seen that. He knows that things fly. He knows what it's like to put gas in a car somewhere. So he's putting all of those things together and creating something new. And so that's what starts to come out in that last phase of play. So one of the things I want you to pay attention to is the vast difference between Tate and Zachary and Ethan. From their like body control and strength to their visual focus to gross motor, you know, you think of Tate like loosely trying to tap that thing. And Ethan has built this Lego thing and he's manipulating it, this fine motor skills, attention, cognition, language, all that stuff. Okay. We're only covering a developmental span there of about 4 years. Okay. So the difference between Tate and Ethan is about 4 years. Which when I think like, what did you look like 4 years ago? So if I showed a video of you 4 years ago and a video of you today, it wouldn't look that different, right? And what we're seeing there is really drastic, really, really drastic change. And this kind of progression of skills and progression of development of language and a higher level cognitive skills is just really critical for development. Because in our everyday lives, we simultaneously have to operate in both concrete and abstract realms. And this type of symbolic play, especially what you saw with Ethan at the end, is really integral to language development. So language at its core is a symbol system, where we use a very expansive system of visual and auditory symbols in order to understand and express really variable and complex ideas. And the human capacity for development of language is directly connected to the development of symbolic play. So as babies develop into toddlers and toddlers develop into preschoolers and kindergartners and big kids, the neurons in their brains are forming these neural pathways and just mapping information like at a really alarming rate, really quickly. And one thing I did want to say actually is when I tell people that play is connected to language, that doesn't totally make sense. There's not an automatic connection. But when I was doing clinical work, play is always the place you start. So when I would have kids come in for evaluations who had language-based issues, you don't start by assessing their language. You start by assessing their play. Because if they don't have the symbolic play skills, you can almost guarantee they're not going to have the language skills. Because they're so closely tied together. And parents, when I would do treatment with kids, parents would say, why are you just playing with them? He's not talking. I want him to talk. And it's like, he doesn't have anything to talk about. And he doesn't have the ability to talk because this symbolic relationship isn't there. We have to work on that first for him to be able to even have the capacity for language. It's really, really a critical thing. So here's a little linguistics lesson. So when kids hear an adult say a word, articulate sounds for a word. So for example, when they hear the sounds m-a-t in that order, neuronal connections in the auditory cortex translate that into a cognitive concept of something different, or something that is flat and it lays on the floor and you can like lay down on it and rest on it or take a nap on it. But if I change one sound, so if I replace the M with a B, so instead of m-at, mat, it becomes b-at. So it's a different visual symbol. It's also a different auditory symbol. Then you get something completely different. You get a flying rodent that carries diseases and eats mosquitoes. Okay? Very different things here. With minimal, you see what I'm getting at, though? Minimal change to the auditory and the visual symbols. But vastly, radically different meanings. Danny, that one's for you. I was going to do a baseball bat. I hate bats, but I dedicate to Danny here. Okay? But then, again, I'm going to manipulate it again. If I take that bat and I just transcribe the first letter, so I leave the vowel in the middle, and I switch the T and the B. So the sounds are the same. The letters are the same. I just move them. Again, we have a totally different thing. We have a tab, which is a metal ring that helps us open aluminum cans without cutting our fingers, right? So these tiny, 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 seemingly tiny changes are happening, have just profound impacts on our understanding and our use of language. And this is what kids are doing. And this is one reason that play is so critical, because this symbol system, if you don't have this symbol system, you're not going to have functional language. So a child's ability to play well, to play symbolically, to play abstractly, is critical to their ability to acquire language. What they understand, how they talk, what they say, and eventually how they write and read. So all of those neurotransmitters firing are creating new neural pathways that are really critical. So play isn't just for fun. It's really necessary for a huge part, important part of human development. Play is not isolated to humans. Obviously, we know that some animals play as well. But it's part of what makes us human. And it connects us to this big, big component of what sets us apart from the rest of the animal world, which is language. And language is also a significant thing that connects us to God. So Genesis, in the beginning of the Bible, Genesis tells us that God spoke the universe into being. The Gospel of John tells us that Jesus is the Word. These are really profound things. This isn't just symbol that we're talking about. The idea that the God of the universe is a God who uses language and has created us with that capacity too is really significant for what it means to be human. So what does play accomplish? Play is integral to brain development, creativity, curiosity, cognitive, language, motor, social, emotional skills. Kids learn how to learn. They gain motivation. They explore risks. They make choices. They gain independence. They learn to concentrate, test boundaries, and have fun, which is another big piece of it. So what's the problem? What's the problem with play? This is all a really cool thing. But in the past few decades, our view of play has changed. Adults are busier than ever, and so by default, children are really busy. The world is a more dangerous place. Kids don't often have the time or the freedom to roam as freely as they did in previous generations, and this is a really big issue. So I've just shown you why play is important for humans, but now I want to talk about kind of what's happening and what has happened culturally in the last few decades to change our view of play. And so now I just want to take a minute to go back to the question I asked at the beginning of the lecture when I asked you, what's the first thing that came to mind when I mentioned play? So pull that back up in your mind. Generally, people either remember a toy, like a specific toy, or they remember a specific activity. Okay, so just show of hands here. How many of you, when I asked that, thought of a toy, a specific toy that you had as a child? Hands, hands, anybody? Many. Okay, and so then how many of you imagine an activity? Okay, yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay. That's not what I was expecting. That's okay. Generally what happens is people who are on the more mature end of the spectrum think of an activity. And people on the younger end of the spectrum think of a toy or a particular object. But that's okay. I'll tell you why in a minute. But anyway, you guys are defying the statistical odds here. Okay, so I'm going to talk about kind of four areas that cause us to have a problem with play. And the first is a wonderful world of advertising. So according to Alex Spiegel in his segment for NPR, prior to the mid-1950s, toy companies had tiny advertising budgets and therefore primarily reserved all of their advertising for the Christmas season. But in 1955, the giant toy company Mattel began advertising a toy called the Thunder Burp at Christmas time. It was no one would ever sell it now. It's a plastic machine gun, essentially what it is. It was very popular. So the gun had sold well initially, but many of the toys were returned because the children didn't really know how to operate it. It was so complex they needed directions on how to operate it. But around that time, ABC, the television network here in the States, offered Mattel a sponsoring opportunity for their new TV show, The Mickey Mouse Club, in exchange for advertising time for the Thunder Burp gun. No one really remembers the Thunder Burp gun now, but it's described as kind of this watershed moment in history because all of a sudden television advertisement for toys became much more commonplace, and all of a sudden children's play became less focused on certain activities and more focused on specific toys, increasingly designed to address certain aspects of play and predetermined scripts. Howard Chudikoff, who's a cultural historian at Brown University, said this: almost overnight, children's play became focused as never before on things, on the toys themselves. He argues that up until this point in human history, children's play consisted of children playing outside, roaming around in large or small packs, mostly unsupervised, for hours at a time. They were seemingly doing nothing. He says, they improvised their own play, they regulated their play, and they made up their own rules. So think about that for a minute in comparison to kids you know now, if you have kids or if you spend time around kids. And think about that in terms of comparison to your own childhood. I had a lot of toys. I was like a number one consumer. I was like in front of the TV every Saturday morning wanting every toy that came on. However, I spent a ton of time roaming around our neighborhood with my sister and the other kids in the neighborhood doing probably things we shouldn't have been doing, but with very little plan or structure for hours and hours and hours, and my mom would just call us in when it was dinner time or when it was bedtime. Chudikoff argues, during the second half of the 20th century, play changed radically. Instead of spending their time in autonomous, shifting make-believe, children were supplied with ever more specific toys for play and predetermined scripts. So essentially, instead of playing pirate with a tree branch, they played Star Wars with a toy lightsaber. So you see the difference there? Chudikoff calls this the commercialization and co-optation of children's play, which is a trend that begins to shrink the size of children's imaginative space. So kids just don't need as much, you don't need as much imagination to play with a lightsaber and play Star Wars than you do out in your yard with some tree branches, right? Another trend that dovetailed with the increase of advertising of toys is the use of toys for marketing purposes. So it's really commonplace now for any popular television show or movie targeted at children or at tweens to have a whole line of merchandise to go with it, primarily toys. So even in the realm of toys, the toys themselves are becoming more and more specific, allowing less space for creativity, exploration, imagination. So a good example of a contrast is between good old-fashioned wooden blocks. So these can really be used for anything. They can be used for building anything. You can hide them. You can throw them. You can use them as a hammer. You can do a lot of things with these. And they can be something different every day. You could do something with them different every day and really just put your imagination on them. But compare this with Legos, modern Legos. And Legos are great. I don't want to diss Legos. However, Legos more and more now are, the common thing with Legos is that you don't just get a big bucket of Legos. Legos are sold in these sets. So this particular set is Hagrid's Hut from the Harry Potter movies. Okay, so this is a perfect example of both a toy being part of the marketing for a film that's come out, and then just such the specificity of the toy itself. So like the wooden blocks, building with Legos helps kids work on fine motor skills and their visual perception skills, and you can do anything with Legos too, right? You can make anything with Legos. However, by labeling this Hagrid's Hut, kind of all the creativity, imagination, and exploration is taken out of the activity. It essentially becomes a following direction and a fine motor, a building, a motor activity, not an imaginative activity. So instead of creating something novel, kids are like intently studying the like multi-page directions that give them step-by-step instructions on how to build Hagrid's Hut or whatever it is. And then once it's built, it's kind of done, right? So what do you do with it next? Do you preserve it for all time and put it on the shelf and there it is? Do you take apart and rebuild it as it is? This depends a little bit on the kids. Some kids are like, no, those are the Legos that go with this set. Because then once you mix the Legos in the set, it's kind of all downhill from there, right? So there's just a real, this toy becomes much more finite than others similar before. The second cultural shift that's happened is fear and safety concerns. This has caused a pretty significant uptick in parent supervision of kids all the time. In her article, The Overprotected Kid, if you're interested in this at all, this is a great article. Hannah Rosen did this article in The Atlantic a couple years ago called The Overprotected Kid. She explores the way that our obsession with safety has stripped children of independence and self-discovery, but without actually making them any safer. So according to Rosen, there were two major events that spiked this trend in the late 70s. The first was a number of really public lawsuits filed by parents whose children sustained serious injuries as a result of playing on public playgrounds. So all of a sudden, safety experts were testifying left and right in court cases about the potential dangers of playground equipment. And these same experts rained down a new set of guidelines for children's playgrounds as a result. According to Rosen, they had concerns about everything from the height of slides, the space between the railings, the danger of loose hooks holding parts together, One of the primary areas of concern was the asphalt, or the dirt, upon which most of the playgrounds were built, and the potential for head injuries if children fell to the ground, even from a distance of as little as like 3 feet. So while the proposed changes weren't requirements, they were just guidelines, almost all schools and public facilities complied, primarily out of pressure from public outcry and a fear of potential litigation from accidents. So as a result, across America, most playground structures now look like this. You guys, I'm sure, have seen this many times somewhere. So the ground is covered with an artificial substance that's like a cushioned padding. And the slides and the swings and the barriers are all made out of large, solid pieces of plastic. So theoretically, you can't get caught on anything. And then most of the elements are at heights that are really only interesting and challenging to toddlers and preschoolers. If you're much older than that, this isn't really an interesting, challenging thing to play on. Very few playgrounds now offer elements of surprise, adventure, or challenge. And you can find the same exact equipment from playground to playground to playground, regardless of where you are in the country. According to Rosen, at the center of the safety obsession is a belief that children are wholly unable to assess and negotiate risk on their own. So as a result, one of the primary ways that children can learn the critical skills of assessing and negotiating risk, which is through play, has been taken away from them. At one point in history, it was assumed that children had the intelligence and the problem-solving skills to navigate most dangerous situations on their own. Again, this is what I was doing with the kids in my neighborhood. Should we step in the creek? Should we not? Should we try to cross the creek? Should we not? Depending on the day, depending on who was the wisest one at the time, right? We were figuring those things out. And kids just don't have the opportunity anymore to navigate those types of situations. Joe Frost, who was an early crusader in playground safety, has expressed concern that maybe the worry about safety has gone a little too far. He states that adults have arrived at the view that children must somehow be sheltered from all risks of injury. In the real world, life is filled with risks. Financial, physical, emotional, social, and reasonable risks are essential for children's healthy development. And play is the place that children learn to navigate risk from an early age so they're equipped with dealing with it down the road. But the reality is that despite all these changes in playground structure, children aren't actually safer than they were 40 years ago. The frequency of emergency room visits related to playground equipment was roughly the same in 2012 as it was in 1980. And the same is true in regards to children's deaths related to playground accidents. The more horrific accidents related to playgrounds that made the news and first prompted the wave of lawsuits in the late 70s continue to remain kind of just the freakish exception that no safety proofing could prevent, that accidents are just going to happen. In fact, however, there's one type of injury that has increased in that span of time connected to playgrounds, and it's injuries to long bones. So your long bones are essentially from your hip to your knee and your shoulder to your elbow. So there's been a spike in kids coming into the ER with fractures and breaks in those bones. And the thought behind this trend, I think this is so fascinating, is that children literally no longer know how to fall. They don't know what to do with their bodies when they fall. So if you start to fall, our bodies have sort of instinctual things that they do. We pull up, we curl in, you know, when you sense yourself falling. But children rarely have the opportunity to actually practice that anymore because they're used to falling into a ball pit, onto a really soft surface, a cushioned surface, or from very low heights, or having a parent constantly shadow their movements. And so I've watched kids before, and instead of doing that, when they step off of a platform or something, and they kind of like splay, they do the opposite. They kind of splay their body because it's like, somebody's going to catch me. The ball pit's going to catch me. Mom's going to catch me. And so as a result, they have had more broken bones. So not critical injuries, but huge spike in those injuries. I was at a seminar a couple years ago, and the woman doing it was an occupational therapist, and she told a story about her grandson. I think he was about 8 or 9. And at his school, there had been so many safety concerns about the playground that over time they had just removed piece by piece by piece, so that all was left was like the padded surface and some benches for the teachers to sit on. And so what did the kids do? They started a game where they would run from different distances to leap over the benches where the teachers were. And her son caught his foot on it and broke his femur. You know, so an 8-year-old with a broken femur. That's really common. That type of thing is really common now, which is crazy. Ellen Sandester is a professor of early childhood development in Norway. She wrote her doctoral dissertation on young teens and their need for sensation and risk. But she noticed a trend among teenagers who did not have appropriate outlets for exploring risk and sensory experiences, that they instead turned to more high-risk and reckless behaviors. After having her first child, she noticed how sterile children's playgrounds had become and wondered if the same phenomenon could be happening to children. So she decided to observe and interview children on the playground. And she concluded that children have a sensory need to taste danger and excitement. But the key here is that they don't, what they do doesn't actually have to be dangerous. It just has to feel that way to them. So she identified 6 types of risky play that are important for kids to experience. Think about this if you, the kids in your life or the people that you know who have kids, if they let them do these things. Exploring heights, handling dangerous tools, being near dangerous elements, so like fire or large body of water, rough and tumble play, speed, and exploring on one's own. Okay, so again, it's important to remember here that children only need to feel that they've encountered something dangerous. But in order for them to even do that, this requires parents to take a huge step back, which a lot of parents aren't able to do. And she identified that the last one, exploring on one's own, as being the most important for children, especially in regards to having to take responsibility for their own actions and consequences for their decisions. So this leads to the second set of events that Hannah Rosen identified as negatively impacting children's opportunities to play. Around the same time that the public concern began to peak about playground safety in the late 70s, there was another news story that made national headlines. A 6-year-old boy named Eitan disappeared while walking to a bus stop in New York City. He was never discovered. They never discovered what happened to him. But there were all sorts of theories that emerged about kidnapping, possible sexual abuse, all kinds of things. So the case, this particular case sparked the movement of putting missing children's faces on milk cartons. Mm-hmm. I remember that. I don't know if any of you guys remember that in school, but the little milk cartons we had missing kids on them. And that the new normal is that children should never talk to strangers. So it's very common now to hear parents say that things aren't like they used to be, and the world is a much more dangerous place than it was when we were kids. However, statistics show that random disappearances and kidnappings like Eitan's continue to remain the anomaly, kind of like the really severe playground accidents. They're still the exception to the rule. These types of kidnappings, it's hard to believe this if you watch the news, but these types of kidnappings and disappearances actually have not increased in the last 30 years. We hear about them more because of the 24-hour news cycle and social media, but statistically, it hasn't increased. In fact, crimes against children have dropped alongside the drop in overall crime rates. But what has increased with the rise in divorce and custody wars is the number of children who are abducted by a member of their family, usually the non-custodial parent. According to Rosen, she says, the gap between what people fear, abduction by a stranger, and what's actually happening, family turmoil and custody battles, is revealing. What has changed since the 1970s is the nature of the American family and the broader sense of community. For a variety of reasons, divorce, more single-parent families, and more mothers working, both families and neighborhoods have lost some of their cohesion. It is perhaps natural that trust in general has eroded and that parents have sought to control more closely what they can, most of all, their children. So many of kind of the no-brainer things of yesteryear, so playgrounds walking the distance between school and home, unsupervised play, playing in the street, children wandering the neighborhood, are seen today by parents as some of the biggest dangers to children. And so as a result, parents and schools have been driven to create separate environments for children to minimize the risk and to secure them against all the supposed threats. So, but unfortunately, the secure environments also significantly limit a child's opportunities to play in the ways that actually allow them to learn the most critical things that they need for survival as adults. So just the prolific presence today of the special padded playgrounds, enrichment classes, camps, organized sports, play dates, constant parental supervision are all evidence of this like culture of fear around children that has materialized. I want to read a quote. Lenny passed on to me a chapter from a book called Out of the Ashes by Anthony Esselin. It looks like it's a pretty recent book. Was it just published this year? Very recent book. So I just want to read a paragraph that he writes about this. He says, "You do not feel comfortable sending your children outdoors to play. Of course you don't. You have no neighborhood, only a geographical area. You have no local school. You do not know any of the mothers nearby. Old people live far away. Everyone is indoors or in a sports corral somewhere. Small businesses are gone. Responsible people are never to be seen because they are at work, both mother and father. They live too wealthy a life to afford more than a couple of children, so that you never have a sufficient number of children just roaming about to get going a game of anything much. The older people do not play cards with one another. No one visits anymore. Hospitality, your home's openness to anyone who might show up at the door any day, any hour, is a thing of the past." And then we talk about a lot at LaBrie. So this type of loss of community and increase in controlled activity kind of dovetails very neatly into the third category that has affected the way children play, and that's our cultural obsession with achievement. This may be something that you guys have or do personally feel even now as an adult. So it's not a novel idea to say that Americans are focused on efficiency and achievement, but it's hit a fever pitch within the past few decades. With more mothers in the workplace, the proliferation of technology, and living much further away from family and friends, it's safe to say that life often feels like a race. But childhood has become a race as well. Busyness is really an epidemic now in the American family. I've done an entire lecture on busyness, so I won't repeat that here. But busy children are just as much a part of the game as their busy parents. And what are we busy doing? Achieving, mostly. In an article for The New Yorker, Joshua Rothman blames the problem on modernity itself. He says, "Careers mean more to us because the traditional sources of meaning, like religion, mean less. Increasingly, work is the field upon which we seek to prove our value. More than ever, parents' value is not only measured by their children's performance, by their own performance, but by the performance of their children as well. Parents are concerned with getting their children into the best schools, getting the right scholarships, getting the right opportunities, getting on the right sports team. And from a really young age, children are herded into like formal classes and training, soccer clinics, science camps, piano lessons. Again, none of those things are bad in and of themselves, but it's the obsession around that. And even infants and toddlers are in music and art classes. I got a text from my friend today who texted me that she and her son were on their way home from swim class, and he's 13 months old. Like, he can't even walk yet. And he's been in swim class for like 4 months or something, 5 months. It's fun. He enjoys it. But it's probably not going to be the next Michael Phelps, right? I mean, maybe. I don't know. But to have such a little guy in swim class. So part of this trend can be blamed on the desire for parents to have their kids in safe and controlled environments versus just, like, roaming the neighborhood unsupervised like a pack of wolves or something. But these types of, like, uber activities aren't necessary for most children, and they prevent kids from being able to engage in the type of free, unstructured, non-adult-mediated play that's shown to be beneficial for most children. for all children, really. The kiss of death for a speech pathologist is when you ask a parent how much time during the week their child plays, and they say, oh, we have a play date every Thursday from 9 to 11. There's nothing wrong with play dates, but if that's the, like, window of time in a week that your child has to play, like, it's just bad news for a kid's cognitive and language development. You just, like, know you're headed for dark waters. But when we're relegating play in the same way that we relegate, like, going to pick up the dry cleaning, it's bad. And thanks to social media, part of what comes along with the obsession with children's achievement is a new kind of competition between parents. So all of a sudden, the number of activities and the type of activities that your child is enrolled in becomes like the marker for your success as a parent. How much you love them, how much you care about them, how committed you are to their future success, how badly do you really want them to get into Harvard. In this case, Facebook and Instagram have really become every parent's worst enemy, because with a touch of a button, you can see all the achievements of every kid in your child's kindergarten class. And then all of a sudden, parents who just hang out at home and let their kids, like, dig holes in the backyard with sticks look neglectful. I mean, they really do. So speaking of social media, I love this picture so much. On Instagram, my friend Kelly posted a picture of her son, Soren, at soccer practice. He was Soren at soccer practice. He was 3 and a half at the time. And Kelly, the caption of this picture on Kelly's Instagram post was, worth every penny. So I don't know what she paid to put Soren in 3-year-old soccer, but I love this picture because he is showing you much better than I could, what 3-year-olds think of organized sports. Okay? So anyone looking at him could be like, what is he doing? You see all the other, like, compliant, well-behaved kids in the back, like, lined up at the soccer goal doing what they're supposed to be doing. I don't know Soren super well, but he is obsessed with superheroes. So my guess is he's laying there and superheroes are, like, doing something amazing up in the sky is probably what's happening here, if I had to guess. Which at 3 is what he should be doing. That is, this is more appropriate than that at 3. But, you know, Kelly was like, I felt so bad. I was so embarrassed. These are real things. And so with all of these activities and enrichment classes, kids are also spending a lot more time commuting, sitting in cars as they drive from activity to activity. Families are on the go a lot more than in generations past, and they travel further distances to get to school, to visit family and friends. Younger siblings especially average more time in the car for the sake of their older siblings. There's a new generation of kids referred to as bucket babies, which has to do with the advent of the snap-and-go car seat stroller combination. This is Tate again. So for those of you who don't know, the snap-and-go is a car seat stroller you can buy, and it has this seat, and the whole seat locks into the car seat, and you can pop it out and lock it into a base for a stroller. So the baby doesn't have to be lifted up and moved. You just move the whole seat. Very convenient. However, what happens is that then babies can end up, it's possible now for babies to end up staying in their carriers for hours at a time. So you think, like, riding in the car to drop off your big brother at school, then riding on the shopping cart. You can just pop that thing out and set it on a shopping cart in a grocery store or something. Riding on the shopping cart while mom buys groceries. Back home to unload the groceries. Mom has a snack. You get back in the car, go pick up big brother. And hours could have gone by, and the baby hasn't come out of the seat. And so babies now are stationary and strapped in much longer than they ever were in the past. Hence the term bucket babies. It's like you're carrying them in a bucket. I know from my friends who are occupational therapists that it's really important for babies to actually hang out on the floor. They actually need to be on the floor, rolling over, grasping for toys, trying to push themselves up on their hands and arms. That's how you build trunk strength, arm strength, leg strength, all that stuff. And exposure to those types of muscle and mind strengthening activities is increasingly limited as babies and young children spend more and more time being strapped in. Studies have also shown a rise in issues with visual and visual spatial skills in infants because of the constant pressure on the back of their heads. So babies have quite soft heads, and your occipital lobe, which is the back part of your brain, is where your visual center is. And because babies are always, there's just always, even if it's light pressure, pressure on the back of their heads, there are more and more children with vision issues and visual spatial issues as a result. So it's no surprise. Oh, I had another one too. Oh, yeah. This is my friend's kid. This is my friend Finley on the right and his twin brother and sister in their Snap and Go stroller at the airport. So same thing. They probably, I don't know where they're going, but they probably got put in their strollers to go to the airport. Their seats came out. They went in the stroller. They probably didn't come out of those seats until they got to their final destination. Either they were in them on the plane, in the car. I don't know where they were going. But anyway, that's another picture of that. Finley's very cute. So because of the cultural drive towards achievement as well, children's play, just this casual play, is getting inched out in favor of more enriching activities. And because of budget cuts and teaching pressures, schools across the country are cutting down on physical education and recess. So in most American schools, children now have about 20 minutes of recess or free play during the day, and that's it. We're moving towards a testing-based system of education, and so teachers really feel the pressure to take advantage of every minute in the classroom in order to get their students ready for the standardized test that they have to take. So between school, commuting, enrichment activities, kids are moving less and less. And this not only contributes to the epidemic of obesity in America, but it impacts their ability to learn. Studies have shown that attention, multitasking skills, executive function, self-regulation, and behavior are all significantly improved by frequent movement and impaired by lack of movement. And I would say that is true for adults as well. In one study, researchers looked at brain scans of 7 to 9-year-olds who participated in a daily after-school program encouraging movement and fitness in kids. The kids gathered for a short lesson on fitness, and then they had 70 minutes of exercise and playtime. The children who participated in the program were shown to have much better performance on multitasking tests than kids who were not in the program. You can see here the difference in the brain activity. The kids on the left who were in the movement program and the kids on the right who were on the wait list. That's really significant. So the last cultural shift here I'm going to talk about is technology. I'm actually not going to say very much about this for the sake of time, but I also don't think it's necessary because it's in the news and media everywhere. But essentially, the increased presence of technology in the hands of children is not doing anyone any favors anywhere. I'm mainly talking about smartphones and tablets that can go with you everywhere, as well as toys that are modeled after these types of devices and marketed to kids. Most of these toys function for children as cause and effect toys. So if you remember earlier in the lecture when we went through the stages of object play, this is stage 2, which emerges at about 9 months. So it's the cause and effect thing. So handing an iPod or an iPad or an iPhone to a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old is essentially having them play at a level that nine-month-olds and 1-year-olds are doing because they're just clicking something and getting a response most of the time. When older children spend most of their time playing with devices, they're not actually engaged in a way that facilitates brain development, and it particularly impacts attention. There was an article in Psychology Today that said this: whether infant recognition of their parents' faces or students paying attention in class, children's immediate environment determines the kind of attention that they develop. In generations past, for example, children directed considerable amounts of their time to reading, an activity that offered few distractions and required intense and sustained attention, imagination, and memory. The advent of television altered that attention by offering children visual stimuli, fragmented attention, and little need for imagination. Then the internet was invented, And children were thrust into a vastly different environment in which, because distraction is the norm, consistent attention is impossible, imagination is unnecessary, and memory is inhibited. And there's study after study after study supporting this. We're sort of just in the personal technology has been around just long enough now that they're able to really study it and study a lot of longer-term effects on it. So, you know, parents may feel much better about children's safety and well-being these days, but the kids are actually the ones who are getting the short end of the stick from all of these changes. Across the board, American children, I'd love to hear in the discussion, we have several people in this room who are not American, so I'd love to hear any differences from other countries, but American children specifically demonstrate decrease in attention, problem solving, physical coordination, strength, creativity, abstract language, self-regulation, and responsibility. All of that has gone down generationally in children. And we need to think really critically about what kind of environments we're creating. And I think for those of us who are Christians, we need to take a serious look at how these trends impact us. How are we shaped by advertising and consumerism? How does a culture of fear impact our own trust in God? What are the ways that we place our value and our identity in our own achievements over God? What place do we allow technology to have in our own lives? So these are things that we all need to really think about. How are these things in conflict with our faith values? So on that note, I'm just going to move into talking about this a little bit from a theological perspective. It's kind of hard, actually, to talk about play from a theological perspective. The last time I did this lecture, a woman came up to me afterwards. She was here. And she said, "That was a really great lecture, but the Bible doesn't talk about play." She's right, specifically. So I'll see what you think of that. Put something together. The Bible does not specifically talk about play. But I think that the Bible does talk a lot about being human. And play, I hope I've conveyed to you, is a critical piece of human development. It's a really important piece of being human. And I think that play is a critical component to our lives as believers in Christ, both as beings who believe and also as believers who must be in this world. Here, you know, I kind of want to go back to Jacob. It's like, why don't I just lecture on baseball? But anyway, we're too far into it here. Theologian Jamie Smith has done some helpful work on this. Some of you have read some of his things this term. He, in his book, Imagining the Kingdom, he writes about worship, and he paints a picture of worship as a physical body united with story and imagination. He notes that our embodiment is a core feature of our humanity, and that we can't separate anything that we think from our bodies. We all experience all of life through our physical selves. He makes a really strong argument that humans are actors before we're thinkers, meaning that our actions are generated much more by what we love than what we think, which is quite different from what our culture would tell us, that we're more thinking beings. It was actually only a few decades ago, not that long ago, that neuroscientists thought that babies came into the world pretty much with the vast majority of their cerebral hardwiring already in place. But we know now that that's not the case at all, and that our experiences all throughout our lives are massively formative, not just to how we think about things and view things, but literally how our brains function. Our experience is really important to that. We currently live in a culture where the cerebral is highly valued above many other things. But Smith points out that what we think comes primarily from what we first experience through our senses and through our bodies. Anyone who has ever played a sport or been a dancer or played a musical instrument, been proficient at any of those things, you know that our bodies have a way of knowing things, of holding memories, of holding information that is separate from just our cognition. I was thinking a number of years ago when I was in my early 20s, I was in a car accident. And for probably 6 months or a year after that, when I was driving, every time I had, and in the car accident, I had to, a woman pulled out right in front of me. I had to slam on my brakes really hard. The road was wet and we just hit head on. And for 6 months or a year after that, when I was driving, any time I had to slam on my brakes, even if it wasn't her, my whole body was like on fire. Like I could feel my hands tingling and whatever. You know, I wasn't thinking about the wreck. I wasn't, you know, I was injured, but not really badly. It wasn't, you know, but my body held the memory of that experience in a way that was beyond what I was thinking of. And I'm sure many of you can think of good and bad examples of that, of the way our bodies hold those things. And excuse me. But we also can't separate our intellect from our bodies. Smith says that our action emerges from how we imagine the world. So it's this evidence of a strong connection between what we do and who we are. They're really tightly tied together. So the stories and the actions of our lives, both real and imagined, shape our character. So play, on the one hand, can lead us sort of back to the beginning, back to creation. When we talk about stories, there has to be a beginning. And through our imagination, play can be a helpful way to get us back there. When we think about play, our minds often go back toward childhood, towards innocence, when the world seemed fresh and new. We often talk about that with kind of wistfulness and sentimentality to say, oh, to be young again, or back when I didn't have any worries back in the day. That tends to be how we think. And when we talk about play or think about play, it can move us in that direction. And while sentimentality doesn't always serve us well, being led back to the beginning of something often does. In the first few chapters of Genesis, when the world is new, Genesis says that God the Creator gave it shape and form. We had a world before sin and it was good. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says that Christ is the wisdom of God. It's a strong connection between the life and the personhood of Jesus Christ and the wisdom of God. Proverbs 8, it's a lovely chapter if you want to go read the whole thing. But Proverbs 8 is giving a description of wisdom, but also a really interesting picture of creation. So if you think about Paul and his connection between wisdom and Christ, you can imagine the Son present as the Father creates the world. And this is written from the perspective of wisdom, or from the perspective of Christ. That's the I. I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was constantly at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. Some translators say actually that a more accurate translation of the word rejoicing here would be laughing or playing. So either way, what we have here, this is really abstract, so stick with me, it's kind of hard to get your mind around, is a picture of the playfulness and the joy of Christ present with the Father in the creation of the world. As image bearers of God, we are also creators. That's part of the mark that we bear in the world. In case you haven't noticed, almost every child fancies themselves an artist. But I can't even count the number of times I've heard an adult say, oh, I'm not an artist. Oh, I can't do that. I'm not an artist. But I've never heard a child say that before. But it's still true of us. In his book, Orthodoxy, G.K. Chesterton writes this. It might be true that the sun rises regularly because he never gets tired of rising. His routine might be due not to a lifelessness, but to a rush of life. The thing I mean can be seen, for instance, in children when they find some game or joke that they specially enjoy. A child kicks his legs rhythmically through excess, not absence of life. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. That's really powerful. So when we go back to the beginning, before the fall, before the brokenness of the world crept into our minds and our hearts, we see who we were originally made to be. Play takes us back to the beginning, back to the place where we love because God first loved us and loved us enough to make us in his own image. And play allows us to continue the work that God created in the garden. It didn't end with the fall. It's good work. We have good work to do. And play gives us an avenue to continue to create, to continue to speak, to continue to imagine, and to relate. And so while play can lead us back to creation, it simultaneously is a door that can lead us forward toward eternity. Imagination is a requirement to even begin to think about eternity. You can't do it if you don't engage your imagination. But when it's integrated into regular life, play helps us get there, or at least get a little bit closer. We live in a temporal world, and it can be extremely difficult to get our minds around dwelling with God forever. What does that even look like or mean? Sociologist Peter Berger, who's at BU, actually, he says this. In playing, one steps out of one time into another, which I think might be one of my favorite definitions of play. For those of you who have played, who have really played, you know that this is true. Somehow, when we play, there's a shift in how we experience time. It is almost as if we step outside of time and the weight of everyday life is just lifted off of us. It can also leave us flustered at times because we say, like, oh no, I've lost track of time, or where did the time go? Which, if you think about it, is like a weird, it's a weird statement. It's a weird concept. Berger says, and I love this, that play creates an enclave in the everyday, a territory that is separate from the normal rigors of time. He says this, when one is playing, one is on a different time, no longer measured by the standard units of the larger society, but rather by the peculiar ones of the game in question. In the serious world, it may be 11 a.m., on such and such a day, month, and year. But in the universe in which one is playing, it may be the third round, the fourth act, the allegro movement, or the second kiss. In playing, one steps out of one time into another. And I think a lot of the sentimentality that exists around childhood has to do with that period of life when death isn't a reality. Our own death, the death of those around us, the death of the world that we live in. Many people argue that play is just a way to escape the harsh realities of adult life and to deny what will inevitably come, which is death. But from a Christian perspective, play is not a denial, but actually a preparation for all of us of the true nature of what death means. It's not an escape from death, but it's a preparation of what it means to live for eternity with God. Berger says that joy is play's intention. And C.S. Lewis calls joy the serious business of heaven. And that's ultimately what God calls us to, the joy of our union with Christ in the place where death is no more. Not because we don't die, we will die, but because death is not the final word. We're always being called out to more. To play is not just the work of children. It's the work for all of us who long to see the kingdom of heaven realized in the world. And it helps us give us access to the creativity and imagination necessary to glance at that eternity with Christ while we're still here. In his book, Eugene Peterson, pastor and theologian Eugene Peterson, has a book called Christ Plays in 10,000 Places. And he takes that title from a poem by the priest and the poet Jared Manley Hopkins. And this is part of the poem here. It says, as kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim and roundy wells, stones ring. Like each tucked string tells, each hung bell's bow swung finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same. Deals out that being indoors each one dwells. Selves, goes itself. Myself, it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. I saw more. The just man justices, keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces. Acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. If you're familiar at all with Hopkins' poetry, if you've been around here very long, you've heard Sarah and Liz both share some of his poems. His poetry is actually a wonderful example of an artist playing with his form. He plays with sound and with words and with images, and you can just hear it in the rhythm of his poems. But this is a beautiful picture of Christ playing within each one of us, giving evidence to the love and the life of the Father through his creation. In our playing, we evidence the reality of Christ to one another, but we also take what God has made us to be and offer it back in worship to him. Peterson says of his book, a poem is a complex matter of sounds and rhythms, meanings nuanced and plain. The ordinary and the unexpected juxtaposed, all put together in such a way as to involve us as participants in life, more life, real life. That is my intent, to enlist your play in the play of Christ. I don't have anything new to say. Christians already know all the basics simply by being alive and baptized. We are already in on it, for Christ does, in fact, play in 10,000 places. But I do hope to get you in on a little more of it. We who are the limbs and eyes and faces in and through whom Christ plays. So I love that. We are already in on it. Christ plays within each of us, and joy is what God intended for us. It's the work of the Spirit within each of us and a mark of our true freedom that we can find that kind of life in him. In Letters to Malcolm, C.S. Lewis sums it up this way. He says, we, or at least I, shall not be able to adore God on the highest of occasions if we have learned no habit of doing so in the lowest. At best, our faith and reason will tell us that he is adorable, but we shall not have found him so, not have tasted and seen. Any patch of sunlight in a wood will show you something about the sun which you could never get from reading books on astronomy. These pure and spontaneous pleasures are patches of God light in the woods of our experience. I think this description ties in beautifully with the description of play that the Libri students came up with at the beginning of the lecture. Pleasure, wonder, creativity, fun. Scripture tells us to taste and see that the Lord is good. And all of the reasons that our current culture makes it hard for children to play well, it makes it hard for grown-ups to play well too. It's tempting to take a book's description of the sun and just keep going rather than experiencing something of the actual sun itself. But play gives us opportunities to witness and experience that God light that Lewis talks about, and to taste and see something of God himself. And this is the heart of worship, not to read something about God, but to dwell with him in our minds, but also through our imaginations and our bodies in creativity and prayer. Not just to be thankful for God, but as Lewis says, for our minds to run back up the sunbeam to the sun itself. In closing here, wrap up, thank you for staying with me. I want to misquote Shakespeare and say, play is the thing. I hope I've convinced you that play is important and good and crucial and a worthwhile human gift that we've been given, not to be relegated to the world of children's nurseries or preschools. But play is in many ways the real work that we've been called to on this earth. We gain through play a knowing that's far more deep and real than what we can access through books and just our intellectual thought. I don't think I have a slide of this, but for those of you who have read Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think he paints a really beautiful picture of play, of children playing and of Christ playing in 10,000 places. This quote I'm going to read that I don't think I have a slide for is just after Aslan, the great lion, has been sacrificed on the stone table, and Lucy and Susan have stayed to care for his body and to weep over his death. But to their amazement, he breaks through his shackles and is restored to life. "Oh, children," said the lion, "I feel my strength coming back to me. Oh, children, catch me if you can." He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail. Then he made a leap high over their heads and landed on the other side of the table. Laughing, though she didn't know why, Lucy scrambled over it to reach him. Aslan leaped again as a mad chase began. Round and round the hilltop he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them, now tossing them in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them again, and now stopping unexpectedly so that all three of them rolled over together in a happy, laughing heap of fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one has ever had except in Narnia. And whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. And the funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired or hungry or thirsty. I have a very practical streak. I'm always tempted to make these lectures very practical, and I'm going to resist doing that tonight. But I do want to just challenge you to take a look at the ways that you are or are not allowing yourself to play in your own life, wherever you are in your life. Think back to Abby's quote earlier that says, "Grown-ups don't know how to play." So I think your challenge is to prove Abby wrong in that. So I'll stop here, but I want to just leave you with a bit of wisdom that I found in the bathroom, on the bathroom wall of a restaurant in New York City. We don't stop playing because we get old. We get old because we stop playing. We grow old because we stop playing. And I think that's true. All right. I've gone on way too long. I'm going to stop there. For those of you who are new to LaBrie, we will stay and take questions, comments, discussions for as long as people want to stay. I will stay. You do not feel like you have to stay. So feel free to get up and take off whenever you need to. You won't be rude if you do that. So anyway, any comments or questions or disagreements?
I was just thinking about this, kind of helicopter parenting or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was reading this book, talking about just the use of cell, like kids and cell phones, and how it used to be a big deal when a kid would first venture out into the city on their own and have to find their way around and have to rely on their wits and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And now they have cell phones so they can always contact their parents, and their parents are constantly checking in on them all the time. So
yeah.
Like all kids should have a cell phone at that age, and it's horrible that he went missing. he got found. Yep. But I also thought, you know, do all kids who are 9 or 10 need to have a cell phone? But yeah, it goes back, and I've seen kids that are just like, as soon as they get to that school care program, and then they have to like call or text their parents, and they were always like wanting to. And so, and they wouldn't, this one boy particularly would not deal with any difficult personal situations with like the staff or anything, because he'd have to text his parents about it immediately, like he can sort through the conflict or whatever. And it just seemed like, yeah, it's like a real problem taking them out of actually being present in these situations they were in to like deal with their own issues. I know that's not really play, but learning to develop those important skills.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not play, but it ties in with the concerns over safety and the kids just aren't, they just aren't learning how to navigate the world. So whether that means conflict resolution or whether that means how to read a map, kids don't know how to read maps anymore. They just like turn Siri on or a GPS or whatever, you know. I was talking to a friend who's a teacher and that was something she's like, none of my kids can read a map. They like look at a map, they don't even know what to do with it. And those are things that you just think, oh, that's not really a big deal. But those are like really basic life skills, you know? And so what do you do if you don't, you know, you don't pay attention to where you're going in the city because you just think, oh, well, I'll just look at Google Maps and it'll get me back. You haven't paid attention at all to whether you took a right or whether you took a left or whether the train station was close to the brick building or the stone building or whatever, right? And so I think that's part of the issue here is that the people that I know who are educators, it's interesting, the people who I know who are most concerned about this are people who work with college students and young adults. Mm-hmm. So my friends who are in education or whatever, they're actually freaking out a bit more than people who are like the second grade teacher, because they're seeing the long-term effects of young adults who just absolutely cannot negotiate the world on their own, whether it's getting a paper turned in on time or dealing with a bad grade or a misunderstanding with a teacher, or boss. You know, one of the stories, that I thought was crazy is a number of years ago, I was visiting some friends in Washington, D.C., and I went to a party with them. And the woman hosting the party worked for Teach for America, which is a huge volunteer teacher corps. And she, part of her job was training and placing new students. And she told me that they had to start every summer before they had like a new class of teachers coming in. And so these are people who've graduated from college. So these aren't college students. You have to have a bachelor's degree to work for Teach for America. So 21, 22 minimum. They had to put in place for Teach for America a parent orientation in the summer, because she said the amount of time that their staff was spending over the course of the summer fielding phone calls from the parents of their employees, not students, employees, about where they were being placed, concerns about this, you know, they're Teach for America, they're very often in low income neighborhoods, they're not the safest neighborhoods. And she said it went against everything. And I don't know if they still do this. This was just a particular time, but she kind of talked about it just being really challenging. She said, kind of went against everything we wanted to do in doing that. She said, but our staff was losing so many hours dealing with these parent phone calls that we just were like, okay, we're going to have a parent orientation. Save your questions for this time, because the staff was spending so much. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. You know, anyway. Yeah.
I'm not a parent. I don't have kids, so this is all hypothetical to me. Yeah. But watching friends my age with kids or whatever, you mentioned, that all play is adult mediated, that there's play dates, and kids aren't allowed to roam the neighborhood, you think it's unsafe, or you don't know people. And I was just kind of hypothetically to myself wondering if a family decided, oh, we want to take that step back. We want our kids to play imaginatively and go for even 2 hours, not the whole day, and just explore on their own. But you have no one with you in on. If all the parents are
held, nobody's
parents
home
except one, then as a single family, you may not, it may be difficult to give your kids that opportunity if nobody else's kids are allowed to do that.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And there have been,
actually, the other parents will call you a bad parent.
Yeah. And call the police. Yeah. I mean, there have been some issues.
You know that your children are flying alone in your front yard.
Yeah.
I had a mom tell me that.
Yeah. And there have been instances of people calling the police because of abandoned children at a playground or whatever, when very much the mother knew where they were. They lived X number of blocks away. The kids were allowed by the parents. The mom knew, you know, and it's gotten dicey with some legal issues too. Yeah, people who are parents in the room who want to chime in on this, you should. But one thing I did hear, and not every family has the ability to do this, but I have heard some people talking about, saying, okay, we're going to be those parents for the neighborhood. This is something we want for our kids. And so we're going to communicate to other families that, you know, their children are welcome to come play in our yard. You know, their children, you know, our kids are usually home after school. We don't have a lot of afternoon activities. They're welcome to, you know, our kids are available. We're home. We're around. And being the ones to very intentionally provide that presence, you know, but not everybody has the ability to do that. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if anybody with kids, I don't know if you went away on that, if anybody with kids, just on the challenge of that, not to put you on the spot, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you would never know that there's 125 kids on our street,
mm-mm.
But there are, because of the bus system we know that, like, yeah. Right along this lane.
Yeah.
I have not seen a child this summer, not one, except our own.
Yep.
And they're either away at camp.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one child we have seen, I'll take that back, we got a phone call about when we first met him. Don't let your kids play with a little boy because he's not monitored. Okay. And that was the main excuse.
Because he's not what?
Monitored. And he's dangerous. We were told he was dangerous, which there might be something to that. But he's really the only child I have seen all summer. And, like, our kids go in the backyard. But even down here, if they came down here to, like, ride their bikes, like, we've been told, but, you know, where's the adult supervision? And it's interesting. I've noticed this more and more at playgrounds. Children may not play without adult supervision.
Yeah, that there's like a sign on the playground.
Mm-hmm. I remember going riding my bike to the playground. Mm-hmm. I was like 7 years old. My mom would be like, go to the playground, mm-hmm. 5 blocks away. Like, mm-hmm. never would there be a sign that said you couldn't play here.
Yeah.
But every playground we've gone to, children cannot play without adults. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anna.
From a nanny perspective, mm-hmm. I'm married to two little toddler boys. The interesting thing is, if I have different opinions about how much I need to stop a child from doing this or doing that or exploring here or doing that, is that I have to then come home and hear feedback from the parents about whether I, mm-hmm. you know, kept the kids safe enough. So just over and over it happens that I get in trouble with their dad, and not like a beat, and I still get along well, but I get in trouble with the dad for pretty variety of things, but I'll like take pictures of the boys having like the most fun. We all get home just like all laughing, and then it's like, you should know the boys had their feet off, their not feet off, gosh, their shoes off, because what they had gotten their, you know, feet cut. I was like, oh, mm-hmm. really smooth, but and mm-hmm. oh, you shouldn't have had them, you know, on the train. I had to like take they'd gotten really wet, so I brought some shorts and trunks, and I had to put trunks the boys, but they didn't have shirts on. That was really bad. Or the list can go on, and it's a little hard because we have so much fun, partly because I'm not constantly telling them not to do that or not to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't, it's actually a hard one for me to know, though, whether I don't know if there's a perfect spot, because I do let the little 4-year-old on the train kind of stand up and explore. Like, if he starts to fall, he can grab something,
mm-hmm.
and I'll maybe tell him to grab something. But other than that, I do let him kind of like explore like that, and I know that the dad will probably have to sit and get up or something. And the most interesting moment for me sometimes comes when I'm out with these two boys in a public place playing, even having a lot of fun, but I'm not as, like, safety conscientious as I typically used to be. Mm-hmm. Really. And other adults will either kind of, like, give me the look or start to, like, go after the kid. And I'm like, yeah. He falls in the fountain. Like, he actually is going to hurt. It's, like, it's deep enough water. I'm, like, going over to help him, but this other guy's, like, running towards him. What?
Yeah.
I got this. Yeah. Anyway, but I feel like the judgment of people around me sometimes when mm-hmm. I just kind of let the kids explore. And,
yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know that I have it right. The kids may be more likely to get hurt with me than they would be with a really conscientious kid. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
And then they learn
how to get hurt. That's
right.
It's the same and how to get over getting hurt.
Yeah.
To know how far it's too far because it's not going to be that bad. Mm-hmm. If they don't know, yeah. and then they're 20. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're going to have to learn.
I want to show you guys something. I didn't put this in the lecture because it was too long already, but this is a playground in Wales, in northern Wales, called the Land. But oh my gosh, I just noticed that kid is like literally upside down in there.
Pretty dangerous.
I know. He had to get a head injury from that.
Awesome junkyard.
Yeah. So this is actually a very intentional play space that was created in this neighborhood in northern Wales, and there is a wall around it, but one side of it it butts up nice against a creek, so there's water there. But it's essentially there's no formal play structure. There's old tires, mattresses, pallets. You guys saw there's a fire drum. People take old junk and leave it there. And it's a playground that was intentionally designed for kids to explore and take risks on their own. So there are, I don't know if parents aren't actually allowed at all, if there's that rule, but most kids go on their own. And there are adults who staff it, like trained adults who staff it. So there are adults who are present, but they do not intervene unless a child is really seriously injured or, you know,
on fire.
That's something like that. But kids can start fires. They can poke around in the fires. They can ride in a cardboard box down the hill and land and get all their clothes wet in the creek. They roll. I mean, they could do whatever. And it's interesting because you just think, like, who in the U.S. would let their kids do that? But it's interesting because they actually did all kinds of studies and safety assessments and all this stuff before they built this and opened it. And at the time that the article was written about this, it had been open for 2 years, and there had been no injuries beyond just basic, like, scrapes and bruises.
It's
really interesting.
I think it's in Canada that I found when I was looking through things on the internet. Yeah. This kind of thing with a whole lot of railroad ties and
yeah.
all kinds of stuff like
that. And people can just take stuff and dump it there. Like it's not, you know.
There's more and more of this, you know, 50 dangerous things to let your children do.
Yeah.
That, I've seen that list on
yeah.
the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. Brooke.
Because we need some imagination about what's dangerous.
Yeah.
Not too distant from the
right.
future.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, first, just thank you so much for this lecture.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. I've got two comments. My perspective is as a youth minister the past 5 years, and so I see adolescents. And something that I saw a lot of with my teenagers was the amount that they watched Netflix
yep.
and the amount that they played video games. And so talking about playing as teenagers, it seems to be virtual rather than physical. And I worry about the disconnect between their mind and body. So I see that. Another thought I had connected with teenagers, I read an article about something called Rat Park. And I'm actually not sure if they're... I didn't look at the science behind it and see if this research is actually that good, but the point still struck me. But they
rat with a T or with a P? Rap with
rat
a P.
With a T.
Rat with a T.
So,
okay.
so they put rats and they'd have one, you know, a test rat in a very boring cage, and then they would have it's like opiate water, and then they have a different rat in like a theme park, You know, lots of tunnels and colors and places to go and fields to run on and balls to play with.
Yeah.
And they had the opiate water available for the rats in Rat Park, too. Hmm. But they looked at, like, the actual consumption of opiates, mm-hmm. and, like, the rats in the boring space, like, were very addictive mm-hmm. of the amount of time that they'd punch the opiate button mm-hmm. and get drugs. And then the ones in Rat Park just, like, wouldn't.
Yeah.
And so when I've seen like my own teenagers struggle with addictive behavior, and I just worry about like the lack of a Rat Park for them, and then just instead turning on drugs.
Totally. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that's like a Rat Park isn't just. And what would that be? Like, what would a Rat Park for a teenager be? You know, like, you're talking about the importance of sensory input.
Yeah.
You know, real sensory input versus virtual or mm-hmm. just distraction after distraction after mm-hmm. distraction. And I think that's, mm-hmm. like, I would love the next study, you know, like, what...
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kids who have been
organizing their own, not the distraction.
Yeah. What Esalen talks about. Mm-hmm. Esalen has this chapter in mm-hmm. about that he was just astounded one time to be driving in a place
yeah.
where kids used to get together and organize a game mm-hmm. without adults, mm-hmm. you know, and just have a pickup game,
yeah,
a football or ultimate frisbee,
yeah.
or I mean, there's plenty of activities that they can do that they don't need to have it supervised and organized, you know, by an adult. No, not against. Yeah. Those kind of activities also supervised by, yeah. you know, with youth directors and yeah. things like that. But there's so little just taking the initiative mm-hmm. to get a group of kids together and let's play a game. Mm-hmm. Because things, you know, flashlight tag, mm-hmm. There were all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Lenny, it's interesting, like, tying into what Brooks was talking about, like, video games and Netflix and things like that. The thing that Esalen says, he says he was driving by his place. In a large grassy area between the roads and the buildings, about 20 boys, most of them in their teens, were playing a pickup game of football. It suddenly occurred to me that I had not seen the like in a long time. I concluded that their poverty had something to do with it. Because they were poor, they were not spending their time in costly after-school programs. I think you could say they're not, like, they don't have Netflix subscriptions, they don't have access to video game consoles, whatever. And because they lived cheek by jowl, there were enough of them to get up a good game. And because of the lie of the land, there was a big field for them to play football in. And because the old barracks were set at some distance from the center of town, there was nobody to complain that it wasn't safe and put a stop to it. In rich neighborhoods, you never see children outdoors without surveillance and without coordination and co-option by the parents, who always have a weather eye out for what the children might eventually do with the sport they are learning to play. But I think there's, I don't want to advocate for poverty here, but I think there's something in that example of we're like entertained to death, you know, and so we have such easy access, and that's where technology itself isn't bad, but that's where that door open has provided so much of that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That their whole lives are mm-hmm. kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to learn soccer, you're going to learn it this way.
It's like the necessary pieces to get to a very specific end goal of success or whatever. Yeah. Nick?
Andy Crouch in that Bookstorm of the Week talks about human flourishing.
Yeah.
And that for human flourishing to happen, you have to be exposed to meaningful risk and then be exposed to meaningful action.
Mm.
So to be able just to even have the opportunity for risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that you think of these, I think of my kids, and when you schedule it so their lives so much, there's no risk involved.
Mm-hmm.
They don't ever have to mm-hmm. take a risk. And it's interesting, I read this article at the doctor's office. The new parent is called this. The new model of parenting is snowplow parenting.
Instead of helicopter parenting or something.
Removing all
obstacles
to risk and to unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened is this exact thing that that woman who wrote the book How to Raise an Adult talks about, the lack of executive function now.
Yeah.
That people who are 16
you know what that makes me think of is we have, some of you know this person, but we have some former colleagues who worked with us at LaBrie, and their younger son, who's now 20, is probably the only, he was the only teenager, and he's the only young adult I know who has virtually no connection online. He's not on social media. He won't return text. He's just like not engaged with that at all. And he, part of this is just his personality, but he grew up at LaBrie. We cut and chop a lot of wood at LaBrie. And from a very early age, he was taken with the students out his kitchen window chopping wood. And he's been chopping wood forever. And he's been out. He's been out with Dick and his chainsaw from a time he was an early teenager. He got a chainsaw for his 16th birthday. What's that?
Led him astray.
Dick, it's Dick's fault, right? He's owned his own chainsaw since he was 16. He's been operating a chainsaw for somewhat independently, somewhat supervised for longer than that. Chopping wood. He teaches the students. He's like, oh my gosh, I don't even know. I've got to go out there and this is a mess what they're doing out here, you know, and showing students how to chop wood. And I don't want to say that that's a formula, because he is who he is. He's a particular kind of kid, but he's now an arborist, and he spent the last two summers working for a tree company in Ashland. And so he's learned to climb. He's not a rock climber, but he can climb trees. So he's like up in the top of trees with saws and chains. You know, I mean, that's what he's doing for work. And I have to think that there's something about that for him. It's, he's just not, he likes movies. He likes normal teenage stuff, but he's not on social media. He's not on video games. He's not, you know, he's doing.
One amusing story. I asked his parents' permission, can I let him run my chainsaw with very careful supervision and a careful log and so on? Yeah. And he did a very good
job. How old
was
he, do you remember?
No, I don't remember. But I asked his father, how did it go? We came back, and it was all clear to the parents. And Joe said, it was his bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I wanted to ask you, in your work and research on this, if there's connection between the decrease of risk and also lack of, what's a bar mitzvah? Categorical.
Rite of passage.
Rite of passage. Yeah.
Yeah.
Passage.
Yeah.
And so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is. I haven't done a lot of research on it. It hasn't come up a lot, but there is. And I heard a really interesting, just a couple months ago on, I was listening to Tom Ashbrook on NPR. And he was doing a story, this was a couple months ago, I don't know if you guys heard about this, but there was a student at Penn State, who, a guy in a fraternity who died as a result of hazing in a fraternity, and they charged something like 18 fraternity brothers with his death. I mean, they just hauled some serious charges against a lot of guys. And so he was doing a show on this, and a father called in whose son was a freshman at a different university in Pennsylvania, not this one, and his son had gone through Rush and was joining fraternity, and the dad made the comment, you know, I didn't want him to do it, I wasn't in favor of him doing it because I hear these stories, but my son really wanted to do it, and he doesn't agree with a lot of the things he was asked to do and the way things were done, but he feels like he went through something. He went through a rite of passage alongside these other guys. And the dad equated it to being 18 and going into military service, like in the way that you're like, okay, you're in the bunker with these guys and you've passed through something yourself, but also with these other people. And so you then have these bonds like you don't have. And the dad said this, he said, you know, like, kids aren't friends the same way they used to be. They don't have the kind of friendships they used to have. They don't have the kind of bonds with one another. And the dad was saying, I wish we had rites of passage because I think that's what my son is trying to work out for himself. Like, I think he's trying to do that. and it, whether that's associated with a real physical or emotional risk or something or not. So I think, yeah, I haven't read a lot on it, but I've heard some friends who are older, who have older kids, who've kind of struggled with that 12, 13, 14 year old age, more with boys than girls, but even both, trying to think like, okay, this feels like a significant time. I want to mark it, but they're like having to create something out of the air, right? Yeah. There's no, except for certain religious contexts and stuff, there's nothing in place.
The interesting thing in pre-modern society is the rite of passage is doing something that is deeply significant within the main things in that culture.
The community, right, yeah.
And here we're talking about a life, right, rite of passage to get blind drunk.
Yeah.
Or maybe another...
And harassed and...
Or yeah. Maybe another possible... These. Right of passage is getting a driver's license. That's more, it's closer to what's yeah. basically vital to America, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm kind of sad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I've often, as a Christian, thought, what could one invent as a rite of passage that would only work if it was done by mm-hmm. a number of people all at once? But it's sort of sad that there's not a rite of passage yeah. that's more integrated into what's important to life.
Yeah. Johan, you said sex. Is that what you said?
Yeah, just in general.
Just says it, yeah.
Just dig it up.
Yeah. No, definitely. Aaron, did you have something? I'm sorry, I saw your hand earlier.
I did, actually. It's actually connected to something personal today.
Yeah.
My youngest brother is a 14-year gap between us. Hmm. So I like seeing babies now because I tell people I'm forgetting what it was like to have young kids in the house. So I've actually... various reasons started watching him, like literally Big Brother in the house. And we've been having problems. I want you to elaborate on the statement that how virtual reality doesn't engage in the same way as other forms of play, because we've been having problems with laptop addiction. Mm. He has an extremely violent temper, like me, and my parents have been trying to figure out how to handle that. I have a friend whose mom is a psychologist in Connecticut, so I saw a link on her Facebook page a month or so ago, and I shared it with my parents because I was so fascinated, because it was talking about how one reason the virtual reality is so bad is because it tends to excite, in an illustration, it tends to excite the same fight or flight mm-hmm. responses. It's kind of like going through boot camp every day, almost. And I was starting to realize why Elias could be so calm one minute and then, like, just raging the next, like, just slamming mm-hmm. his fist on the table and stuff. It happened today. I heard him, and I came mm-hmm. out and talked to him. And as soon as he got off the screen, he's like, I'm bored. So he said, mm-hmm. okay, let's go to the library. And when we go to the library, he, like, turns into a different person. We actually mm-hmm. ran into some friends. He was talking. I think I saw him playing a game in the corner. Mm-hmm. So it was just like a real in my face today.
Yeah.
And based on this lecture, I was curious if you knew anything about that fight or flight thing, because I haven't mm-hmm. really read much more into it.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know a ton, but that, I mean, you're right. When you're, and I don't play video games. I haven't played a video game since, like, Atari at my neighbor's house when I was, like, six or something. But, really, that's probably the last time I played a video game. Mrs. Pac-Man at Pizza Hut. From what I understand, video games now are, I mean, the technology behind them is so advanced. So they're so real. The images, your experience as the gamer... Of what you're doing, it's just so real. And I think when you're focused on a screen, you've got a joystick or button or whatever you've got in your hand, and I think that the issue is that most video games that adolescent and young adult men are playing are war battle fight, right? They're quite violent. I mean, it has to do with that. And so, they're so real. They're so, I mean, I've had people who play video games regularly say, like, oh, yeah, I can sit down to play a video game, and, like, all of a sudden 3 hours is gone. And like, I have no idea that I've been sitting there for 3 hours. Like there's, it's so engrossing. And so when you're that engrossed in something, like your whole system is there. So you really are, you know, it's not just your mind. It's not just your hand on the joystick. It's your whole body, your whole system is getting revved up. And then to just like turn the panel off and walk out the door, you know, then you're back in your living room. I mean, that's a huge jump. I think one of the things, too, in the idea of it being the separation with reality, I think one of the issues, too, is that there's no consequences to any of that, right? So you're spending 2 hours or 3 hours on this military mission to hunt somebody down and kill the enemy, and maybe you do it. And some of the games are quite graphic. And then you turn off the computer and you walk away. And you've had not the exact same experience, of course, of doing that with your body, but like you've had an experience of hunting someone down, of stalking them, of strategy around them, of killing them, maybe killing them in a really violent way. And there's, that has absolutely nothing to do with what you do 5 minutes later. There's no consequence for that. There's no, you know, and so I think part of the issue with that is it's really normalizing that kind of behavior. And people will say all the time, oh, I mean, I know it's just a video game. It's not real. It's not real. You hear that all the time. And while on the one hand, they're right, it's not real. It's a video game. It's a virtual reality. But there is an experience of reality tied to it that has none of the repercussions of something like that happening in real life. And so then you are more likely in real life because you've had this experience of doing something, it was no big deal, of doing something similar. It's not consciousness. You know, that's not a conscious decision to do that, but that's part of the argument against. I don't know if other people know more about it than I do, but...
Well, just even in regards to, like, Rat Park, so the experiment in Rat Park was it was more to do with isolation. Mm-hmm. That what happens in isolation mm-hmm. is a tendency towards not necessarily boredom, because I don't know if boredom is necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
But it's the isolation. It's yeah. being alone. And this is what virtual reality, you're alone.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the idea that being with people, even when you're bored,
mm-hmm.
what it creates
mm-hmm.
and that I think even just like in virtual reality and video games, just you're not able to self-regulate.
Yeah.
And when you're with people, you're able to do mm-hmm. that in a more natural way, and your adrenal system isn't as flooded.
Yeah.
And yep. this idea of a flooded adrenal system and what yep. you do with the flight or flight thing.
Yeah.
When you're with people, you can do that
yep.
better than when you're alone, because there's nobody being like, what's wrong with you?
Right, right. Your pupils are dilated. You haven't moved your face in 10 minutes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The pushback from your peers, even when they're 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, to be like,
what are you doing?
Why are you?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
It's just like what happens in isolation
yeah.
And addiction to everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I think tied onto that too, from a Christian perspective, from a biblical perspective, is going back to this idea of embodiment. Like, we were made embodied. And I think the thing that's really, and again, this isn't something I've done a ton of reading or research on, but the thing that scares the crap out of me when I read about technology and where things are going and where it's moving and what people are trying to do is they're really trying to circumvent the human body. They're trying to circumvent the limitations of the human body. And, you know, people are fascinated by this and they're excited by this and they're thrilled by this. But we were made in bodies and it was called good. Our bodies and the limits that our bodies have are not a result of the fall. Adam and Eve were made embodied before the fall. Our bodies are marked by the fall. The reality of sin is present in our bodies, but our physicality and the limit of time and space is, we were made for that. That's how God made us. And I go back so often. There's a verse in Psalm, I think it's Psalm 16. I was getting confused. One of the teens. I think it's Psalm 16 that says, "The boundary places have fallen in pleasant places for me. Surely I have a delightful inheritance." And I just love that because our instinct is to push against the boundaries, to push against the limits, to push against the form. But if we look at a biblical picture of it, the form is the source of our freedom. That's how, you know, we think of it as one or the other. It's an either or. And that's what the world tells us, is an either or. And the way technology is going and just virtual reality is moving way out of the realm of just video game consoles, right? I mean, it's all over the place. And it's all about how bad limits and boundaries are for us. But from a Christian perspective, what scripture tells us is that that's where life, that's where we find life. Versus, you know, the further we move away from our bodies, the less human we become. Our bodies are such a huge piece of our humanity. And it's such a, I think what Nikki was saying about the Andy Crouch book and talking about the importance of human flourishing. We can't flourish outside of our bodies. We just can't, because we weren't made for that. And so that's what's really scary to me when I read those things. And I think there are a lot of people who would give up a lot to be free from their body, to be alive, but to be free from the limits of their body. And I think, you know, video games are just one way that that happens, but cell phones are too. We can be standing in one place and communicating with somebody who's half a world away. It's the same thing, but just a different. But yeah.
What you're saying about boundaries and limitations,
yeah,
that I've been exploring that a little bit more recently too. And it's really helpful to be challenged to think that way, because I think that so many of the things that make us just like dissatisfied with our bodies are because, like, we are fallen and there are things that go wrong with it. And mm-hmm. there are,
yeah,
but like, it's, I've been challenged to think, nope, my body isn't bad, but the effect of,
yeah,
our sin, even just physically, and the mm-hmm. way we get sick, and it's like,
for sure,
it's
death.
But
death.
I, yeah, like, only recently have I really been challenged to think about it that way. And I think mm-hmm. it's easy to blur the lines. And this idea that boundaries are a good thing, I'm like trying to preach that to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the boundaries are okay. It's just that sin has affected it in ways that,
yeah,
that are not good. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the boundary isn't good. And
right,
even in creativity, like we're talking about, we're creative people, playful people, like mm-hmm. the blank canvas. You can be more creative when you give yourself a boundary, like, oh, mm-hmm. let me try. What if I try to do it with these rules? Mm-hmm. And then, like, that's when my creativity opens up.
Yeah.
Like, we need those boundaries to be creative and be free, but it's not the way our culture talks about
nope.
it. It's not. And I wonder, too, if some of it is just, you know, misplaced hope, because...
Mm.
Like, we have the hope of a resurrected body. Like, the things mm-hmm. that are wrong in our bodies will be made right.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have that hope, sure, you're going to look everywhere mm-hmm. for some escape from that.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have to escape it. We have to, like, medical advances isn't, like, that's all good.
Yeah.
But ultimately, like, we have to live with what we have now, but we have hope for something more. So we can
absolutely.
Be okay with
yeah.
where we are.
Yeah.
And the boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing you made me think about is for those of you who have strong, maybe Presbyterian or Calvinist leanings, you know, there's the idea of total depravity, kind of talking about specifically in that theology, total depravity. And I think there's a, not just from that, but there's a asceticism that exists in Christianity about our bodies and about the depravity of our bodies. But I think it's more, we talk about this here sometimes, it's more helpful, instead of using the term total depravity, to use the phrase pervasive depravity. Because sin has touched everything. It has. But that doesn't mean that every single thing about my body is sinful.
Right?
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. That there's so much good too, that God looks at his creation and says, it is good, and the goodness is still there. It has been marked by the fall. It has been affected by the fall. and that's part of the dance they were doing, I think.
With all the new technology, too, it's just like a new form of Gnosticism where we're like downplaying embodiment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was thinking about the last part of your lecture and just play as resistance to the darkness of the world and play as anticipation to what is coming and and heaven and the kingdom come. And just, you know, the play of God is creation. And when we create out of his creation, when we recreate or recreate, I think that's all, like, that's very connected to what it means to play.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of freedom. I mean, you have to be in a place of freedom to really, and trust, I think, to play. And I was holding on to those words, the descriptive words from the beginning of trust and security and in watching students, little kids that I used to teach, those that were afraid, those that had experienced trauma or weren't secure, they don't play. They don't have that. They just don't. They can fight, but they don't have to play. And just thinking of that as an adult, too, to be in a place of freedom, to really trust in God and trust in what is to come.
Yeah.
That gives you freedom to play.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think since I did this lecture the first time, I've done another lecture, I guess it was just last term, on Sabbath. And if you do any reading at all on Sabbath, play comes up all over the place. And it's interesting. One of the books that I read for that is Walter Brueggemann, who's at, wrote a book called Sabbath as Resistance. And there is this idea that we are, resisting the push of the culture, and we're saying no. There is something more that is coming, and there is something more that is here now, as well. And part of observing Sabbath and practicing Sabbath with play and rest and community and fellowship, being part of that, it doesn't just mean you're asleep on the couch all day, right? And creativity and creation, all being part of that, is this twofold, it is an act of resistance against where we stand right now, but it's also an act of faith, and trust to say what we are doing is practicing what we believe is coming, right? Of inviting the kingdom and practicing for when the kingdom, does come. Yeah. Lenny.
More along those lines, I think something I was reading about play recently too talked about play is an end in itself.
Yeah.
And we're totally about, our lives are so driven toward that everything's a means to an end. And we're so involved in, and, you know, we've got to make this happen.
Yeah.
But play involves self-forgetfulness. You're not conscious of, I'm doing this so that I can get this, or be there.
Or how good am at it am I, or how do I appear.
There's the right kind of play, you're totally self-forgetful, and that, I think theologically, that's, we are meant to lose ourselves.
Yeah.
And you lose yourself in play, in the right kind of way, so that it is very much a model of what it is to be not all wrapped up in what I can earn or be driven towards something.
Totally. Tim Keller calls it blessed self-forgetfulness.
That reminds me, too, of just play can be like something you do, and I feel like it can also be a little bit of a mindset, like being able to trust and rest and let go of things.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's grace when that happens. Mm-hmm. But one of the phrases that always comes back into my brain during like a conversation like this is something a professor said when I was graduating from college. He was giving the seniors the address, and he was challenging us as we left, you know, these 4 years of academics, and we're growing and learning and going to go into the workforce, and he said that his challenge to us was to cultivate an informed readiness to worry, to wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was interested when the wonder came up.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not that you're living oblivious to all the challenges. It's not that there are good and hard things. But even through that, cultivating the ability to wonder at things. And that's very playful.
Yeah.
And it's very blank.
Having a sense of awe, too.
Yeah. I think we need to cultivate that.
Yes. I would say yes to that. Agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anything else? Thank you guys for sitting for such a long time.
Thank you very much.